And then the next section of Swadhyaya is the worship of Tulsi Devi. And then the glories of Tulsi Seva. In the nectar of devotion, we find the following passage glorifying Tulsi Devi. Let me offer my respectful obeisances unto the Tulsi tree, who can immediately vanquish volumes of sinful activities. Simply by seeing or touching this tree, one can become relieved from all distresses and diseases. Simply by offering obeisances to and pouring water on the Tulsi tree, one can become free from the fear of being sent to the court of Yamaraj, the king of death, who punishes the sinful. If someone sows a Tulsi plant somewhere, certainly he becomes devoted to Lord Krishna. And when Tulsi leaves are offered in devotion at the lotus feet of Krishna, there is the full development of the love of God. Skanda Purana, quoted in the Nectar of Devotion, chapter 11. Tulsi is glorified throughout the Puranas and Pancharatra. It was for the spiritual upliftment of the souls in the material world that Lord Vishnu created Tulsi, as the ocean of milk was being churned. Tulsi is more dear to the Lord than Lakshmi. For Tulsi Devi undertook extreme austerities and worshipped the Lord with love in order to have him as her husband, and the Lord fulfilled her wish. There is no better recipient of charity than a vipra, no better gift than cows, no better tirtha than Ganges, and no better leaf than a tulsi leaf. Whatever one can obtain by offering the Lord all types of flowers and leaves can be obtained by simply offering him one tulsi leaf. An offering of flowers made of gold, jewels, and pearls is not equal to an offering of tulsi leaves. By offering the Lord tulsi leaves, a devotee is released from sins accumulated in 10 million lifetimes. When a devotee offers tulsi to the Lord's head, all the devotee's unmentionable and undetected sins are destroyed. By sprinkling the Lord's house with water using a tulsi leaf, one is freed from all great sins. A person who has amlaki fruit or tulsi leaves in his mouth or is on his head or body when he dies is guaranteed not to suffer in hell. So to the glories of Tulsi, Tulsi is very dear to Krishna. He is one of her, his atonal associates. So he doesn't accept anything without Tulsi leaves being offered. So because of her being so dear, then it's all very much part of the deity worship to perform worship of Tulsi. So this is, part of the program. We want to perfect the deity worship. This element must also be there. So then you have the daily worship, either in the morning, evening, or both times, that we offer prayers to Tulsi, we offer artik to Tulsi, we circumambulate Tulsi, and offer our obeisances. Then additional to that, those who are doing the temple puja and that, then they can also worship Tulsi. And the first thing we do is we're offering our prayers to her. She's offering bath. Very simple. They go through, they offer the first rite of prayer. O Srimati Tulsi Devi, who are previously created by the demigods, is worshipped by both of them and the demons. O Srimati Tulsi Devi, kindly take away my ignorance and accept my worship. I offer you my humble obeisances again and again. Then sprinkling some water on Tulsi. I am bathing God Tulsi Devi, who is very dear to Govinda, who is the mother of the universe, who gives life to all the devotees, and who bestows devotion to Lord Krishna. Then we offer argya. Things that have been offered to the means these are all things that have been offered to Krishna. In other words, sprinkling with bath water. Then, with the conch. O Tulsi Devi, I offer my obeisances unto you, the shelter and residence of my beauty and opulence. So I've been worshipped by the Supreme Lord. O Tulsi, please accept this argya I am offering with devotion. Then after argya, then we offer the nice flowers that were offered to the sandalwood, that were offered to the deities. Then garlands and other things like that. And then achman. And then we offer some prayers. O Tulsi Devi, I offer my repeated obeisances unto you. the mother of Mahapashad, you increase everyone's good fortunes and remove all diseases and anxieties. And then we offer our obeisances and circumambulate her. Or then we pick the leaves for the worship. Yeah. He mentions here is when we're picking the Tulsi leaves, then we should be picking the leaves with the right hand and we should be holding the branch with the left. It means it's one of the rules that it's mentioned that the branches should not shake when we are picking Tulsi. It's not that we just come and we just pick. One has to very carefully pick. And if you catch the leaf, if it's a single leaf, then you just take with where the leaf is, the leaf where it meets the branch. Then if you're picking manjaris, then just below the first two leaves, or whatever, sometimes they grow many leaves, or many manjaris, but whatever, the first two leaves, if you grab them just around the two leaves, just where the two leaves meet the stem, and you hold a little below that and pull, then there's a natural place, it's very soft, and it'll break there. So that is proper. It's not considered improper to do this. Some prefer to use scissors or like this, but then you may miss that spot where she naturally will break. You know, it's considered that the scissors will do a nicer job. But we should know where that place is. You know? But otherwise, the hands are quite respectable. Like this. So, but the main thing is that the braces should not shake. Yeah. Krishna Chaitanya, he himself mentions using scissors or a knife to cut is not considered so proper. And it says, do not pick the tulsi leaves before daylight or in the evening after dark, nor any time on the Dvadasi Tithi, the day following a Kalasi. Means the Dvadasi Tithi. If it's a Maha Dvadasi, so fasting following a Kalasi on Dvadasi, then it means that day. It's whenever the Dvadasi Tithi is. It's not the day when we're fasting from following Ekadasi. That may be on Ekadasi, and the next day is Dwadasi, or Mahadwadasi means we're fasting on the Dwadasi Tithi, breaking on Triodasi. In either case, it's when it's Dwadasi. So you see, if it says Shuddha Ekadasi, then the next day is Dwadasi. And if it says Mahadwadasi, then that means it's the same. They're mixed. That is her appearance day. So that day, then we are not picking the leaves. So you just pick some extra leaves on the day before, and you don't worry about them if they go dry or anything. Going dry is not a problem. Krishna will accept sea leaves, whether they're fresh or they're dry. But then dry means you should keep them nicely so that they do dry, not rot. Right? You get what you need for the day, and if you need extra, if you're traveling or for some reason it's difficult to get, you're bringing from another place, so pick extra and then keep them nice and airy so that they dry nicely. And dry leaves are also very acceptable to Krishna. To Krishna, it doesn't matter if they're fresh or dry. Is there fresh available, then you'll use that. But if they're dry, that is quite fine with him. He is happy with that. And if you can't get tulsi leaves, then if you have a tulsi stick, then you make making the offering, then just before the offering, you touch the items with the tulsi stick. Then Krishna will happily accept. This is in case you cannot get tulsi leaves. Okay. So here, we're worshiping tulsi, then after offering the prasadam to her. So this bath, and the Argya and the Gashna Pushpa, we're just offering. And then the Charanamrita and the Mahaprasad garlands and that, those are coming from the deities. So what we're sprinkling on her leaves in that will be plain water, right? That hasn't been offered to the deity. Otherwise, then her leaves will become. If you pick those leaves, or you pour prasad on the leaves, prasad water on the leaves, then that will not be so proper for offering, right? So, Harinamrita, that's if it's plain water. This is not without the sugar in it, without the yogurt and stuff like that. This means just after bathing the deities, that plain water. We best bathe the deities in the Panchamrita, then the argas and the other things that are being offered, that can be used. So that will be poured on the ground. You know, you put the flowers and other things around the ground, or you're decorating your pot nicely and all that, and that takes care of the worship there. Is there any questions on this? Speak more loudly.
Three times something happens in the eyes because of some reason. So we couldn't do it.
So if you can't grow Tulsi, then you keep a picture of Tulsi. You know, you get a nice, you at least get from somewhere either, you know. You get a nice picture and frame that, and then you put it on a table, and you do the worship book, like that. Then you use a Tulsi stick, like that. Or you get dry Tulsi from somewhere else where they can grow it. Like if you find that there's anybody in the congregation or anything that can grow, or maybe into the weather there is something, but another part of Israel you can grow, then you grow there. And then after that, then you pick a bunch and store them and then offer them as you need.
Yes. Nowadays I see shampoo selling from Tulsi.
You see them sell
shampoo.
Shampoo from Tulsi.
Yes. What does this mean?
What does it mean? Tulsi shampoo from Tulsi. It probably means that they put Tulsi leaves in the shampoo.
Yeah. No, they produced from Tulsi.
Yeah.
Can use or not.
See, it's many, many medicines can be made from Tulsi because she is the original plant. So naturally, all medicinal qualities that are in any other plant are in her. But generally, we ourselves won't use so much like that. It's whatever in the Ayurveda, whatever is made, everything is offered to the deity, and after that, then it's taken. You know, but that's, you know, generally more respectful. Here it would be a problem because there the medicine that you're putting in your mouth or different things. It's a touchy subject because the point is to find a balance of maturity where you can actually deal with these things. So actually, where we'd be making them, you know, these commercially made items that have Tulsi in them, generally we would avoid those. Because they're not dealing properly with her. The proper respect is not there. It's not being offered to the deity. You know, something like that. Because there's not that much advantage for these things. It's just anything that makes money. Anything that's kind of... Because now natural things are kind of... They found... Before, synthetic made money. Like from the 50s. Like, anything man-made was cheap. And anything natural is cheap. Anything man-made was actually more expensive. It was synthetic. And because it was supposed to be better, right? Man improves on nature. Then you know, that flew very nicely through the 60s. And then late 60s, then it kind of like started to lose some favor. Just in the, you know, amongst the younger people. And they wanted things more natural. And that... And because by this time, then the synthetic things became very cheap, because there was so much of it. And the natural things started to make money. So this didn't catch on until sometime later, when the businessmen figured out they could make money out of natural things. Then, you know, then became popular. So now you'll find, so in India, from turmeric, you'll find different herbs, different cosmetics and other things like this. So then Tulsi also, they try to make a little money off of her also. So generally those will avoid. Taking prasad Tulsi leaf with the medicine, that's quite fine. Because she's very powerful medicinal advantages. Like that. That's why it says Charyamrita cures all diseases. There's Tulsi in it. It's washed Krishna's feet and has Tulsi in it. So it's very, very powerful. Right? That's it. Prabhupada's sister. Her son, I forget what he had. Some very heavy disease. I don't know if it's typhoid or something. And she cured him just with Charyamrita. You know, of course she had to have that faith that it would work. And she had people were trying to take him to a doctor, this, that. She said, no, Charyamrita will work. And it did. Yes? The other species of basil is no problem, because conditioned souls like all the rest of us, you know. There's a joke about Basil, that Basil is, Tulsi's carmy cousin who works in Italian restaurants. Like that. There's no problem with those. It's just what's known as holy basil, like that. Because it's also, in many of the cultures around the world, they know it's a sacred plant. They don't know properly how to deal with her or that. But they just know from, historically that she's sacred. So generally, others do whatever they like, but we ourselves are very careful about dealing with her properly. You know, we'll pick the leaves properly, we'll deal properly. We won't use her in so many ways. Others may use her, but that's between them and Krishna. But for us, we're a little more careful. Yeah.
And what about
chewing Tulsi? Is that right? Tulsi, yeah, that's not a problem. No, it's mentioned that those who chew the Tulsi buds, it means these are after they're offered to Krishna. Then they make great spiritual advancement. These are things we have to be very careful of. This one is one that comes out of Puri. Puri Pandas followed that. But they have their own few particular, they don't chew Tulsi leaves. They have to swallow them whole. It just makes you more a high school. More conscious when one's taking like that. But then they won't the normal thing is when someone has left their body, you start the fire by lighting their mouth. But they won't, because they won't do that in Puri, because they've taken Jagannath Prasad. And they won't sit in an asana when they take Prasad. Like that. They'll sit on the asana to do all the parisesana and all the puja, the ritual before eating. Then they'll remove the prasad and sit on the floor. So they just have their own system. They eat, when someone's sitting down and eating, others will come up and eat off your plate and all that when you're, it's just like when you're formally offering prasad. So they have their own system, Same time as they don't let Westerners come into the temple. So you can understand it's their particular systems. So we don't need to be necessarily guided by them. If they don't agree with how our ways of giving things, then it's good for them, but we don't. Yes. Nectar devotions mentioning the other trees. So if you worship Tulsi, then the worship of all those other trees are taken care of, because she is in charge of the forest, right? It's Vrindadevi, she is in charge. The Vrindavan forest is hers. The Vrindavan belongs to her, and she's given it for Srimati Radharani's service to Krishna. That's her. So that means all the trees, everything's under her. So if you worship her, all the other trees are taken care of. Just like if you worship Krishna, all the demigods are taken care of. like that. So there's no need of separately worshiping any of these things.
Tulsi Devi and
Vrinda
Devi is the same. Yeah.
Yes. Tulsi is her plant form, and Vrinda is her gopi form. Yes.
Is it true that you can gauge the devotion in the temple by
how nicely she grows? Yes, Prabhupada mentioned that. She said she's like the devotional barometer.
And so if she's sick,
then it can mean that the devotees aren't being so careful. Like that. Because if she's really happy and growing mantras, and that generally means that things are going very nicely. If she's not, then it can be a serious indication that the devotees aren't being careful in their worship or in the consciousness or in their dealings, like that. They may be doing the worship nicely and worshiping her nicely. Maybe they're not dealing with each other nicely. You know, in some way, something in the devotional process is going on. So it's said that, we mentioned the five main forms is that hearing Srimad Bhagavatam in the association of devotees chanting Hare Krishna, then worship of Tulsi, worship of the deity, and worship of the holy dhamma. These five items, if they're performed, then devotional life develops very, very quickly. Like that. All the other forms are all parts of these. So these are the five main aspects. Same time as the ritual side of the Tulsi worship also comes under the Pancharatra. So it's part of the deity worship. So, but at the same time, it stands on its own as a form of worship. Like that. Like you said, Haridas Thakur would sit down and chant the holy name, and he would sit in front of Tulsi. Like that. So on its own, it also has. But the ritual side of it, if you're going to do all the worship and all that, that comes from the Pancharatra.
Five last of the list.
Yeah.
The 64 list is the most powerful. And one of them is the serving the devotee. And then when Prabhupada later mentions about the five most important, then instead of worshiping the serving devotee, he includes worshiping the sacred trees. So
Tulsi.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that is because in there, you'll notice that hearing Srimad Bhagavatam in association of devotees, those two are put together. Right? So there's two lists. One is hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, associated with devotees, chanting Hare Krishna, worshipping the deity, serving the holy dham. And the other is hearing Srimad Bhagavatam in the association of devotees, chanting Hare Krishna, worshipping the deity, worshipping Tulsi, and serving the holy dham. Because it's just a matter of what you want to bring out. Because in the deity worship, you have to worship Tulsi. So by saying deity worship, that means also worship Tulsi. But in case someone's not so clear on that, then you can bring that out. And then, and hearing Bhagavatam means you'll hear it in the association of devotees. So those two can also be combined. Because you're going to hear from devotees, you're going to speak to devotees, you're going to discuss it with, because you're going to hear from seniors, you're going to you're going to instruct juniors and you're going to discuss it with equals. So you're going to be serving devotees. But just in connection with Bhagavatam. So it brings out the connection between the Bhagavatam and the devotees. And the other brings out the connection between worship of Tulsi and the deity worship. Like that, because worshipping the Lord without worshipping Tulsi doesn't, he's not as pleased by that. Does that make sense?
What?
means the here. They should just asking about if we attend the temple Tulsi Puja, do we have to then worship our own Tulsi at the house? So here is the two different aspects are given here. One is that of offering the pratik and, you know, pouring water and circumambulating and all that. Once that's done, then it can be considered to be done. Though one would always nice to see that one's own tulsis are watered nicely, and one may be offering obeisances on seeing that. Then the other aspect where one's actually doing the puja, meaning not what we normally, I mean, not the temple puja, but the actual one connected with the deity worship, where you're offering her all the remnants from your own home puja, then that can be done in the home. Like that. But otherwise, if one is doing the one in the temple, then that is good. And then by offering obeisances and picking tulsi leaves and offering to Krishna and seeing that she's nicely watered and healthy, then that is also sufficient. But if one wants to do more, even before picking the tulsi, then one can go and offer respect. You know, means like these prayers that are mentioned here. And offer flowers and chandan and the remnants of Krishna to her, and then pick the leaves. So just in other words, it's just a more elaborate way of approaching and picking the leaves. Either one can offer obeisances and pick the leaves, or one can, after offering the obeisances, then do some simple worship and then pick the leaves. One has to be careful. One, all the considerations of deity worship. Not contaminate, it means that you've offered prasad to her. So you have to wash your hands before picking the leaves. The leaves have to be kept in a container that is not touched the plate or the paraphernalia with the boga on it. Like that. It means these considerations must be followed, the standards of cleanliness. Also, when we say we offer, let's say, you know, Krishna's, you know, foodstuffs and like that. Water can go into the pot. Flowers can go. Sandalwood paste can go. But the boga that's been offered to Krishna, that you won't put in the pot. You'll just show it to her and ask her to accept it. You'll take a piece of swandesh and stick it inside the pot. You'll just show it to her. Like that. So all this, the elements of deity worship, cleanliness, and that must be maintained, and not mixing a boga, prasad like this. Oh. Question is this, whether it's considered offensive if then Tulsi is on the ground instead of on an elevated platform like when she sits in the garden. Just she shouldn't be, if she's on the ground, then she shouldn't be in a place where people will be regularly walking. You know, it should be more in a out of the way place, with kind of her own area. Then if she's sitting on the ground, then that's, you know, if there's nothing else. So if she's going to be in an area where there's going to be a lot of traffic, then it's better to have her off the ground. Unless she's in such a big pot, that the pot's so big that, you know, the ground level, her ground level is quite high, then that's another thing. But if she's in smaller pots, then it's better to have her up. Like that. Like if it's inside the house or on your veranda, a place where you regularly go, then she should be up a little bit, unless she's in a very big pot. The pot's kind of like a stand. You know? So you're going by where the ground level is, not by where the bottom of the pot is. Right? I mean, if you have a pot that's, you know, 2 to 3 feet high, then the ground level at the top of the pot, where you see her coming out of the ground, that's what you're looking at. That should be up, because that's where she is. It means you see her there. In other words, she shouldn't be, her branches and that shouldn't be down around our legs when we walk.
In one of his routine walks in London, the Prabhupada went up to a tree and took a leaf off. Said, does that hurt the tree? And he said, yes, but he immediately that the same with Tulsi?
Oh. The question is that when we pick Tulsi leaves, just like in the trees, that when you pick a leaf from a tree, that it hurts it, but it immediately forgets. Is it the same with Tulsi? No, because she's conscious. But she's very happy if you're picking the leaves for an offering to Krishna. You know, that's why we come up, offer our obeisances, we chant a prayer that we're offering them to Krishna. You see this prayer here. O Tulsi, you are born from nectar. You are always very dear to Lord Keshava. Now to worship Lord Keshava, I am collecting leaves and injuries. Please bless me. And then after that, then we offer another prayer. O Tulsi Devi, I offer my respectful obeisances unto you. You kindly forgive me if I have caused you pain by picking your leaves and mundries, O Mother of the Universe. Because she's always conscious. It means even if it appears to us that she's not alive, you know, leaves aren't growing and all that, but we would call, you know, like that, still that is non-different from her. Like that's, I think some devotees were in the habit to, you know, prune the trees as branches would die and things, they would prune them off. And then Prabhupada said, there's no need, because, you know, whether there's leaves there or not, it's still Tulsi. Like that. Yeah. There's no need to that. We pick the leaves, that does it. They're nice, round, like that. When we pick, when the mandris is small, then it's also good. They're softer than they're, you know, nicer for Krishna. And it also, she becomes more bushy when we pick when they're small. Otherwise, we don't grow very long. Because a particular thin, you know, branch will grow singularly as long as there is one branch. I mean, as long as the manjari is there. As soon as the manjari is picked, from there it'll branch out into two. Like that. So the sooner she's picked, then the more, how you say? The more bushy she becomes. And the less often, then the more she'll be more tall. Anything else interesting? Then the next is Shastra Seva, service to the scriptures. So Rupa Goswami mentions Shruti Smriti, Shruti Smriti Puranadi Pancharatra Vidisham Vina Aikantiki Hare Bhaktir Utpatayaiva Kalpate. Devotional service of the Lord that ignores the authorized Vedic literatures like the Upanishads, Puranas, and Narada Pancharatra is simply an unnecessary disturbance in society. In a lecture, Srila Prabhupada said, Brahma Samhita was not available. But when Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was touring in South India, he collected one Brahma Samhita, handwritten on palm leaves, and copied it. Formerly, there was no press. These important shastras, Vedic literature, were kept in handwriting. I copy from your book, my friend copies from my book. In this way, those who are interested. These literatures were not so cheap. Only highly qualified brahmanas, they used to keep handwritten copies, and it was worshipped in the temple as deity, not that it was available everywhere. Now press has made it much cheaper. We should always understand the granthas, or scriptures, should be worshipped as God. That is sound incarnation of God. This should not be neglected. Bhagavatam or Gita as ordinary books. As you care for the deities, you should take care of the books also. Prabhupada writes in Gita, Bhagavad Gita 16:24. One should therefore understand what is duty and what is not duty by the regulations of the scriptures. Knowing such rules and regulations, one should act so that he may be gradually elevated. Then, in a letter, June 72, Regarding my books, everyone should read. I am also reading. Everyone should be engaged 24 hours. That is the sum and substance. How much you should read and how much you should do other types of service, that has to be decided by each individual devotee. Eating and sleeping should be minimized. Not a single moment should be misused. Excuse me, that's from February 75. The next one's from 72. Your first job should be to make sure that every one of the devotees in your zone management is reading regularly our literature and discussing the subject matter seriously from different angles of seeing, and that they are somehow or another absorbing the knowledge of Krishna conscious philosophy. They are fully educated in our philosophy, and if they can get all of the knowledge and study from every viewpoint, then very easily they will perform tapasya renunciation, and that will be their advancement in Krishna consciousness. Then hearing. Those who listen to the Bhagavatam may put questions to the speaker in order to elicit the clear meaning, but this should not be done in a challenging spirit. One must submit questions with a great regard for the speaker and the subject matter. Bhagavatam 115 purport. So the books must be dealt with very nicely, kept very nicely. When we're using them, they should be kept properly. We shouldn't keep them on the ground. You know, we should hold them nicely. And then studying, they should be a regular part of our sadhana. You can see here that Prabhupada is very insistent that the devotees should read and study from different angles. And the purpose is that they would absorb this philosophy. Is by absorbing, then there's realization. As we discussed, that the Vedic system was this: one should know the Shastra, one should contemplate the Shastra, one should apply the Shastra, and one should realize it. So unless one knows it and hears it from different angles, from viewpoints, that means contemplating. That's manana, the second stage. First you hear, then you contemplate. So contemplating from the different angles of vision, different viewpoints. That's why you have different persons speaking the Bhagavatam. We get the different viewpoints. We think in different ways. It's supposed to evoke, make thought. Then from that comes realization. Right? If we don't know and we don't think, then we don't realize. Right? So that's the process. All these things must be there. We must do all three. So we must study. So the first starts by shravanam, hearing. The scriptures must be heard. And then once we hear, then Prabhupada gives the fourth stage. After we realize we hear, then we contemplate and apply it. Then we realize, right? So that takes the common Vedic. Then the fourth is to preach. To give this to others. What we know, we give to others. In other words, in the Vedic, they take understanding how to apply and applying it as two. So that's one way. If you're taking realization as the top, then you break it up into that way as four. If you're taking the top as preaching, then you put the contemplation and the application as one, because you contemplate and apply. As you apply, then you naturally contemplate. Then realization is the third, and preaching is the fourth. Like this. In other words, there's always four stages of learning. We must hear this Rupa Goswami's opening statement, is that whatever is not coming from the scriptures, there's not, then doesn't really have any importance. We see the acharyas speak according to the scriptures. You know? So the scripture and the acharyas are matching. So we, as devotees, we want to preach, we should also be speaking according to the scriptures. Then this becomes good. So it must be according to these different literatures. These are the bona fide literatures. If we make our own thing up, it's not so good. It's not the recommended process. Says here, simply an unnecessary disturbance in society. Means we can take things just like we have a principle, you know, simple living, let us take. And so Let us say we're living in a particular country in a particular environment. So now we have learned one should live simple. So then we may look into it, how the locals traditionally would live simply. Because they have, by experience, learned how to live in the environment of we are in, with what resources that are available, in the simplest way, practical way possible. So if you take from that. So this would be Yukta Vairagya. Taking the principle, the Vedic principle given to us by Guru Sahasrara Shastra, then we may take a detail from anywhere, and if it fits, if it supports the principle, and it gets the work done in an efficient way, right? We're doing it for Krishna's pleasure, not necessarily for our own, but for Krishna's pleasure. Then we find that this works very nicely. But now if we disregard the principles and we take those details as principles and not connecting them through the scriptures, not connecting them through the directions that is given by the acharyas, then that is a disturbance. That becomes a disturbance. In other words, there must be some way it is connected. Right? It means consciously connected. Otherwise, then, it can be a disturbance. Right? We bring in something from outside and don't connect it. It carries the flavor of wherever it came from. But if we take something and we connect it through what Prabhupada has taught us, we may find it's not a disturbance at all. It naturally fits in, it adds. But if it's unconnected, it carries its original, mundane flavor, wherever it comes from, whether it's a very refined or in the mode of goodness or anything. But it'll carry that flavor, and devotees will not be overly enthusiastic. So any questions on this, on the scriptures?
Can you give a detail on that? Can you give some examples about what you said?
Which one?
Taking something.
Taking
something and link it to the principle, not the detail.
Well, we were discussing, was it yesterday? No, I think it was yesterday. We were discussing Covey. Now, if you just take it, here's management, and this is how you should manage, and Kshatriyas are supposed to manage, and then you take Covey and try to use it straight like that, then you find devotees are not very satisfied. Right? You gave example yesterday that there was a temple president. He was Grihastha, and so then he used to maintain himself by giving lectures and training teachers and other people in Covey's. It means he worked for the Covey Institute, training people in, Coveyism. The management principle was a Covey. He had to leave his temple because it was so badly managed that the devotees disliked him so much that they felt obliged to leave. Right? So he took the principle, this is management. If I apply it, I'll be a good manager. But some of the devotees weren't satisfied because he wasn't even managing properly like Covey. Covey means you're supposed to be sensitive to the people. But he was not. So it just doesn't work. If you take it that, okay, in the Bhagavatam, it says these are principles of management. Because management is Kshatriya. Here, when we talk about, it means generally when we talk management, we mean Kshatriya management. Everybody manages. That should be understood. When it comes to management, everybody's managing. It's not something that is just the right of the Kshatriyas. Right? Management is part of what a Kshatriya does. A businessman has to manage his business. If he doesn't, it'll fall. If someone has their art, they have to manage it. They have to manage the time. Housewife has to manage the house. A rickshaw walla has to manage his rickshaw. So that it's properly maintained and this and that and be out at the right time in the right places. Otherwise, it's no money. So it's all management. A Brahmin has to manage the puja. It doesn't just happen automatically. Cook has to manage the kitchen. So management is a tool, it's an art, right? But now the application of that art for kshatriyas means those who deal with people, for the is that you're dealing with the people for their upliftment, for their benefit. And in that, you give shelter to those people. That's a kshatriya. A vaishya deals with people, but for the purpose of getting profit. So if the people aren't satisfied, he gets no profit. So therefore, he'll go to great lengths to satisfy them so he can get profit. He couldn't care a damn about the people. He just knows if he pats Mr. Smith on the back and says, you know, how you doing, and how's your family, and, you know, I heard you were sick last week. This man will at least 30% work harder, and he'll get more profit. And these are what all the management people say. No management says that you can't fire the guy if he's a useless bum. You know? No management book says that your business can lose if it's good for two people. No. Like that. It doesn't say that. So the whole point is as a principle, the difference between the kshatriya and the vaishya in management is the kshatriya has to see that the individuals are prospering, right? And the vaishya has to see that the business is prospering. They're dealing with the same principles, the same people, but their goal is a little different. One is shelter, one is profit. Right? It's a very subtle thing. It's just like the difference, what's the difference between a large landlord and a small king? When in 1947, when the kings lost their kingdoms, one of the kingdoms was 537 acres. Right? Mayapur project is supposed to be 600 acres. It means the thing was smaller than basically, you know, from Jalungi up to Yogpeet. It was a smaller kingdom than that. And so what made him a king and someone else, like I knew, you know, one devotee, that his family, they were landlords in Pakistan before the partition. They had 750 acres. So they had more acreage than that king of Gujarat. So why was the one vaishya and their landlord and the other was a king and a kshatriya? Right? Because the king takes tax to protect the people. The landlord protects the people so he can take tax. You understand the difference? Very subtle. It'll look exactly the same on the outside. Like at the time of Shamananda, when you read about the histories of Shamananda, he was talking about so many local kings, but he always mentions that they're gopas. They're vaishyas. Like Nanda Baba, he's a king. But he's the king amongst vaishyas. He's a vaishya, but he's the king of the vaishyas. So under the kings, they have tracts of land, because the king himself doesn't farm the land. He gives the land out to the vaishyas. And if the vaishyas, they grow all the things, because that's their expertise. And then they pay tax to the king. And then the king uses it to protect all the people, so that the vaishya, he can do his things and prosper, and then all that economic development goes for everyone's benefit. Then all those shudras that are working under those vaishyas are protected. Then from that tax, then also then he can maintain all the shudras that are working for him, and he can give charity to the Brahmins. So in other words, the tax is taken to protect all the people that are working under him, and to respect the Brahmins above. Right? Well, the Vaishya will be, that's his business. So it's just a slight difference in the mentality. That's why it's very close. So the Kshatriya will work. They'll do their management on the basis of Shastra. While the Vaishyas will do their management on the basis of what practically works. Right? Just like the king may give his word. Now, after giving his word, it may be seen that he will lose. Now, the Vaishya will change his mind and say, I'm sorry, I can't uphold this deal. But the Kshatriya will uphold the deal even though he loses. That's the difference. It's just the occupation. We're talking about how you run an occupation. It's not talking about the devotee. how he chants, how he reads, how he interfaces with other devotees in the temple. We're just talking, when a businessman is in the seat running the business, there's certain things you have to do. You have to buy cheap, sell expensive. Otherwise, it's not business. All right? But the Kshatriya is not dealing. The businessmen are creating all the economic development. The Kshatriya simply has to protect the businessmen that they can do it. But the Vaishyas themselves generate the economics. The Kshatriya doesn't. He creates an environment in which the Brahmins can function nicely, the Vaishyas can function nicely, and the Shudras can function nicely. But the Vaishyas have to create economic wealth. Right? Because that will be then distributed amongst all the other three. Right? The Brahmana, he gains knowledge that he will distribute amongst the other three. And the Shudra's expert in arts that he will use for the other three. So each one specializes in whatever they have will be given by the others. The knowledge, the protection, the wealth, and the expertise in art. So everybody benefits by this. It means the Vaishya is not greedy. How is he going to get enough to take care of everybody else in the society? Right? You understand? Like a cow produces more milk than the cat needs. Therefore, we get milk. If the calf only produced how much the calf needed, so it's not a fault that a businessman is greedy. Because then he'll work hard and get so much. The fault is if he doesn't give anything in charity. Right? As soon as he gives 50% of what he has in charity, then that's all balanced. Right? And then he's given tax to the king. It means he makes profit. A portion goes to the king. King will use that to maintain the kingdom. Then of what's left, he's maintaining his shudras. Right? That's not in his profit. He'll take care of his people who work with him. What's left over that? So he's taking care of the kshatriyas, and he's taking care of the shudras. So now, what's left, he will use for giving to the Brahmins, to the deities, and to went for activities, you know, for those who are not under his care or not under anybody's care. Sometimes poor people, widows, those who are sick, all these different kinds of things. So in this way, everybody else has benefited. Because he's already before profit. He's already taken care of, you know, the kings and his workers. Right? And the king will take care of his who works with them from this tax. Brahmins don't have very few who help them, and whatever they get in charity from the kings and from the Vaishyas, then they take care of those who work for them. And the Brahmins, when they get in charity, if they get more than what they need, they give that to other Brahmins who didn't have. Let's say one Brahmin goes and does a big sacrifice. Right? It means not all the Brahmins can do. Right? Even if you're doing a big Soma Yagya or something, 9 Brahmins can take part, right? You may have a few more than that in the whole kingdom. Right? So now, you receive 10,000 cows in charity. Right? You need 10,000 cows? Unless you're running a monstrous gurukul, you don't need 10,000 cows. So you keep what you need, you know, 5, 10, 100 cows. Right? And then the rest you give in charity to those other Brahmins who didn't go to the sacrifice. So there's 90 Brahmins, they all get more than what they need. And depending upon their position and how much was given, they may have, you know, 1, 2, 10, 100 times more than what they need from the charity. So in this way, so many Brahmins are taken care of. So the king benefits from giving to that one qualified Brahmin. That Brahmin also, he benefits by giving to other Brahmins. Then he gives to someone else. He gives, say, 100 cows. That Brahmin only needs 5. He gives 95 away. So because of the mood of charity by the three higher orders, then the economics is going on very nicely. So no one is worried that the Vaishya that's greedy and has so much. because he's giving away. No one is worried that the king has so much because he's protecting everyone and he's also giving charity. Right? And no one cares that the Brahmins will get so much because they know that they will give it away also. So everybody is very satisfied. So one understands these principles, then one goes back to those ones, and we see from the Bhagavatam that this is, okay, so this is Kshatriya management, protecting the people. Then, if you don't know some details, you're naturally not figuring them out or haven't learned from somebody, then if you look at Kavi, and then you see, okay, what things in here are dealing with protection? You know? What are not just business tricks of being, you know, nice behavior, superficial nice behavior to get your work done? Right? And so then from that you learn one of the things, you have to deal nicely with people. But now you're dealing with them not because you're trying to just get your work done, but because they're to be protected. Then we find that those elements that you may take from Kavi work very nicely. If you just use them on his own, this book is you think Kavi is bought by kings or by businessmen? Right? Who is buying? Right? He's writing not for kings. He's writing for businessmen or family people. He's writing the book for Vaishyas and Shudras, like that. Basically, he's just saying, don't be, you know, insensitive with other people and recognize that they're also human beings. He's not saying, don't make profit. The whole point of management is to, there should be some good benefit from it. But we have to know the mood in which the management is done. You know, the Brahmin to please the deities, the Kshatriya to please, to protect the people. The Vaishya to create economic development. The Shudra to then please whoever he's serving. So you must know the mood behind it. That we get from scriptures. So if you have a principle and you take a detail without knowing the principle, then you can end up with a mess. Does that make sense? Okay. What did you say? Something? Means Mataji was asking that, you know, it's very common, you know, kind of in the contemporary environment of all different, like, new age elements would be, like, what do you call it, your Reiki's and your yoga therapy and your counseling and psychology and all these different things, and that unless you have these things, you can't actually become a, you know, solid, you know, balanced devotee. And so, is it just a matter of using for Krishna, then that's okay, or is there any other consideration? Consideration that we mention, that you have to understand the principle behind it, still remains. It means Reiki is a system of, you know, how I say, medical help. And if someone has the concentration, has the ability, they may be able to help in some way. Then in your psychological fields and counseling and all that, one has to be a little careful, more careful than that. Means the one is the Reiki, you have to be very careful of interest in siddhi from the yogic siddhis. You have to be a little bit very careful about the planes where it's coming from, you know, that you don't get overly entangled or open unnecessary doors to ghosts and other such living entities. We have to be very careful that we don't think that we are the friend of living entities, the Suridam Sivabhutanam. You know, we are simply trying to help some way we can. And we should not have more faith in the system than what it actually practically gives, you know. So now, in Western psychology, one has to be a little bit more, it's what has to be careful of is that basically it's all based on Freud. Freud studied crazy people. Freud did not study normal people. So all of his philosophy is based on people who are nuts. And so therefore he would look at normal people from the vantage point of people who are nuts. So in one sense one can say it has some validity because you have to be nuts to be in the material world in the first place. If you were actually normal, then we would be in the spiritual realm. Right? That we could look at. But otherwise, there's still no standard. Because the whole point is this principle means you're going back to a standard. See, Kavi talks about principle-based, meaning it's moral. But Krishna's talking about higher principles than that. They have to be devotional, and they have to be based on dharma. So therefore, if we have to be very, very careful that systems that are meant for taking a person who is abnormal and making them normal in the modern sense, we have to understand what that means. Normal means you're a very well-balanced sense gratifier. You exploit the material energy, but not so much that you bother other people. And, you know, if you're not so expert at exploiting, you know, you give yourself a little space. You know, okay, everybody has a bad day. You don't take it too seriously. In other words, you see, take it seriously enough that you get what you want, but not too seriously that when the modes of nature aren't going your way, that you get too frustrated. And you recognize that other people also are in the same field. So you don't get in their way, and they don't get in yours, right? You're okay, I'm okay, you know, we're all okay. It means you enjoy, I enjoy, we'll enjoy, right? Like that. So I will. So therefore, the whole point of morality is we set the fences. Good fences make good neighbors. So I know that, okay, you know, I have my family, and we do our thing. You have your family, do your thing. It's very clear. If you don't have the standards of morality, then kind of the whole family things get mixed up. So we have to be very, very careful because the modern psychology and your other things of New Age don't have a standard. They don't have a standard to judge by that is of anything of any caliber. In other words, where's it come from? It's come from Freud's head or a few other people after him. They put a few, added a few things or subtracted or, but you're still, it's all based on people who are fallible. So your principles have to be Vedic, that are coming from the Shastras, that are coming from Guru Sadhu and Shastra. Techniques you may use, like they have a technique. You want somebody to talk, somebody doesn't talk, right? And we know from the Vedic scriptures that Guhya Mahati Prichuti. That is one of the methods of exchange that I speak my mind confidentially, they speak their mind confidentially. And in this way, you discuss, you know, intimately Krishna conscious philosophy. And both parties benefit from the discussion. So now, if somebody doesn't like to talk, or it's difficult for them to talk, so then you may ask a question or say something, and then you don't say anything. See, the normal thing is you'll speak, and then when there's a silence, everyone gets uncomfortable. So then the natural thing is the person who's easier to speak will speak. Right? So then you just use the technique is that you say something, and then you let that uncomfortable silence manifest, and then you don't speak. So then the other person will naturally speak. So that's a trick. That's one of the ways that they work the psychology. Right? Like you see, they put you in a night, they make you comfortable, put you on a nice couch, and then sit there and throw out something, and then just stop. And they can just listen. They can just sit there and they can control their senses and just wait until you finally say something. As soon as you say something, they ask you a question on that. And then they just keep going. So you can use the same technique. You have to know where it comes. You have to first know what sane is. And Freud doesn't know what sane is. So if you know what is the actual standard of Krishna conscious behavior and interrelationship, what is the philosophy, that technique can be used to help somebody who is very disturbed by material nature. See, Vedic things, you didn't have to worry about these so much because everyone knew the standards and they had been cared for very nicely, so they would naturally care for the next generation. But in most of the time we see when we're coming from the material nature, that we haven't necessarily experienced that. We have maybe had a very rough upbringing, or no upbringing, you know, or we had to take care of ourselves. So it sometimes makes it a little hard for us necessarily to be able to give to others. We weren't given, it's hard for us to give. Like that. So it's just techniques that someone who does know how to give can try to bring someone to that platform. But it still must be based on the proper standards of culture. So that's what has to be seen. That's me. Yukta Vairagya, we can use anything. So just to say I'm using in Krishna's service isn't enough. You have to know directly how it connects. Otherwise, what's the difference? A pujari is doing some ritual, someone will say, why are you doing it? And the pujari doesn't know and will sleep. That's ritualistic. But if we're just following a technique of modern psychology and we don't know factually how it functions in connection to Krishna, then is that not just a ritual? So what's the difference? So Krishna's, Rupa Goswami says, niyamagraha. That either we're too attached to the rules and regulations, but don't know what the meaning is. Or we reject the rules and regulations, the things that are valuable for the same reason, we don't know. So one doesn't know and follows, very dogmatically. One doesn't know and rejects, because it doesn't look practical. So the proper thing is know, and then apply. That's why study is first, hearing is first. You hear first what it is, how it's used, what its purpose is, everything. Then you contemplate. You try to understand it yourself, and then apply it. Okay, because the teacher will give one example, two examples. But in practical life, we'll come across hundreds of examples. So how do we use it? So then we try to contemplate. If we come up with things, nice. If not, we go back to the teacher. And we ask. Then things go nicely. Then from this, we get the realization. And then from that, then it makes it very easy to teach others. So these things can be used as long as they carry the flavor of Krishna consciousness because they're connected directly through. That means they're connected to principles. And we always use our own culture. We always use our own culture. However we use something, even as modern, we use it in our own way. You know, we drive a car as a gentleman. We dress properly. We speak properly. You know, we may use any language, but we still speak like a devotee would speak. Right? Otherwise, if we use these other systems, it'll be short-lived. How long can you, as a full-time devotee, go on speaking in straight-edge language? It's after a while, it becomes very painful because it's too coarse, too rough. So you want to speak more gently. So eventually, one just finds one is more satisfied in one's own, in following our own culture. You know, the Gaudiya Vaishnava culture. Though we may use details from so many different places, that's not a problem. Does that make any sense? So it very much depends upon the mood and the understanding of the person using it. So if they understand properly, it can be useful. If they don't understand, it can be a big problem. Right? Otherwise, psychology, you have this problem, why? What's the bottom line? Because you're not enjoying your senses. You're restricting your senses. Therefore, you're going nuts, right? The mind becomes dissatisfied when it's not, when it doesn't get sense gratification. So therefore, because you're restricting yourself and following these regular principles and doing all these different things, you know, you're getting up early and, you know, chanting all these rounds and all these different things and running a regulated lifestyle, therefore you're not satisfied. So therefore, you just do what you want to do, you know, why you should worry about, why restrict yourself, then you'll be happy, right? I mean, this is the bottom line of New Age, right? So it just means we are the enjoyer, we're the controller. The only difference between this and the traditional system of impersonalism is that the traditional system at least was renounced, right? You know, it's that you're because you're trying to enjoy your senses, therefore you're not satisfied, so you give up enjoying your senses and become God, right? But the modern was is you're restricting your senses, so give up and take your natural position as the enjoyer. So this way become God. So it becomes very difficult. Prabhupada said they're useful as long as one hasn't come in contact with Krishna consciousness. It at least evokes higher thinking, finer thinking, that there's something beyond the gross body and senses. You know, the mind exists, the intelligence exists, the ego exists. But once you come in contact and know that the soul exists, then one has to see everything else in relationship to the soul and the soul's relationship with God. Then, if one is able to use, fine. If not, then... And the Vedic has all these different things already there, right? Niti Shastra tells how people's heads work, right? So like he says, you want to deal with a fool. Fool comes out, has many millions of things to tell you how you should do this and do that and so many things. So if you try to tell the fool, hey, listen, this is stupid, get out of here. No, this, that, they're just making life miserable. It's foolish. They can't tell what's right or wrong anyway. So then Chandraki says, they come to you and says, you know, this, that, this, and you go, wow, that's great, yeah, fabulous, okay, yeah, very nice, thank you very much. Then he's very satisfied, goes away. You get rid of him 2-3 minutes. Then you do whatever you want. You don't follow what he says, because he's a fool. But if you try to just tell him, no, this is foolish, this is sad, you'll be stuck with him for a long time. Because they can't tell when it's time to go. They can't tell. So you just say, yes, very nice, thank you very much, change the subject, you know, send them on their way, and then do whatever you were planning to do anyway. So the whole Vedic thing is how to deal with different people. The whole culture is based because people are individuals. And everybody has their own individual conditioned nature. And therefore, within that, you have to learn how to deal with them individually. Right? What is the general category of the conditioning? Like a Brahmin, it's a general category of conditioning. Right? Or a Brahmachari is a general category of conditioning. So within that, everybody's an individual. So it is the actual personal system deals with the individual. The modern systems aren't actually personal. They don't actually deal with the individual. They deal with some senses. They don't actually deal with the individual. And when it gets down to it, it's just how to work out something between two people so sense gratification can go on. It's not how to work it out so service goes on, or surrender, or leadership. No. That makes any sense? Yeah. is there anything else on this on Shastra? Yes. It's hard to give.
Okay.
The question is, where does it come from? Is the difficulty to give, either in things or in just in care? So this basically is, if we check back in life, we'll probably find that we didn't get much. Certainly, that's what it is. When we were young, we didn't ourselves gain much from others. We didn't feel that they cared for us. So it's just by, in other words, naturally it doesn't come. But we always have to remember that even though this may be our conditioned nature, that it's difficult to take care or difficult to give, that doesn't mean that that is our nature. Right? The conditioned nature is not us. Ultimately, we have to recognize that the mind, the intelligence, the ego is not us. That is our conditioned nature at present. But we're something else. So whatever the mind says and all that, we don't actually have to take seriously. Right? We, just like the body is a different element from us. Earth, water, fire, air. Like the stomach says, eat. You know? But it's japa time in the morning. And you don't. You eat until 9 o'clock. Right? So in the same way, the mind, it says, do this, do that. You don't have to listen to it. It's not us. You can just ignore it. It's not our practice, right? Since time immemorial, we take the mind is us. The mind is the true speaker of our desires. But the mind is not us. It's another entity. Right? It's something else. It's not us. We're just so identified with it. But it's a tool that we use. What it does is functions is this something to do or not to do? To accept or not to accept? That's only that function. So all the discussion that the mind does is generally to come to that conclusion. And where is it getting from? From the intelligence. Like the mind works on memory. Memory is part of intelligence. So the mind accesses the memory of the intelligence to find out in the past what has been the situation with this, if I have experience, right? I'm doing some cooking, right? And then out of all the different things that the mind is pulling in from the senses, it notices that the hand is becoming very hot. So then it accesses to the memory, you know, what does the memory have to say about this? And the memory then says, well, in the past when we used a steel spoon and we left it in the pot too long, it became hot and we burned our fingers. And then for 3 days we couldn't do anything with the fingers. Then the mind immediately, then, you know, connects it to, and then rejects, and then we let go of the spoon. That's what the mind is doing. So when we're going on, what could be this or that, there's so many things, all it is taking, either speculating or taking in the information that it has and trying to put it together to come to an answer. But, it, you know, since that's all it does, it keeps itself busy. You know, it's like the original binary, you know, it's like yes, no. But it goes through all this stuff just to make that. So we can train it. By the intelligence, we can train. By changing the ego, we can change. We can train it. If we're thinking, I am the enjoyer, then the mind looks for whatever's enjoyment. If my identification, no, I'm a Rinpoche, I'm a Tyagi, you know, I'm a big Gyani, then it'll look for whatever, you know, sense gratification it rejects. That's a said is, you know, there was one sadhu, when people would come to give him money, his hands would go behind his back. He would just say it naturally, it just happens. Right? Because his mind is I am renounced. But the Prabhupada pointed out is he is thinking that it is his to renounce, but it actually belongs to Krishna. So we'll come and how much money you want to give, we'll say, yes, give. Take it, and we'll use it for Krishna. So that's real renunciation. So you can change it. Change the mentality. So we're not gyanis, we're not karmis. But we actually become devotees. So we change the ego, then we change our how we discriminate. the intelligence, and then the mind changes how it decides what to accept and what to reject. So with practice, that's the thing. With practice, then even something that doesn't come naturally because we didn't get it maybe when we were young, it doesn't mean we can't get it. It just may take a little longer, that's all. So if we determine, we know it's good, like the, you know, Rupa Goswami says, the Dhatta Strati Grinati, right? Giving and sharing, accepting, right? Guhya Makati Prichati. Guhya means you have to spend time, right? Bunkte Bojate, we take prasad together. So we share prasad or, you know, things like that. So it's there. That is symptoms of love. So if we haven't experienced much, but at least by practice we can gain it. And then it'll start, as we become purified, it will come more easily. And it'll become natural. Like that. So, yeah. Okay. Does that make sense? No. We have to learn if we can take, we can give. See, if we don't take, and then we don't give, that's one thing. Then we should practice giving. Then we will also learn that we can take. But if we're used to taking and not giving, then that means we just haven't matured. We have not matured. Because a child takes, they don't give. But then when they come to maturity, then they give to the next generation. Right? Like a mother, when she was young, she was not giving, she was taking. But then when she comes to maturity, now she's giving. Right? In other words, someone who can follow nicely and lead. Right? Your best student becomes your best teacher. So the opposite is just, they switch. That's what I'm saying, if we didn't receive, we can't give. So the quality of what we received and how we received it is how we're going to do for others. And that'll be what's natural for us, our natural conditioned nature. But it doesn't mean by the process of sadhana that we can't change that. Because we have a culture. So our culture is rich in these things. So we can change. It just takes practice. It may take time. Right? Or, so if we can see, if we're able to take other people's time and take from them, and we're happy, we just have to try to think how, what the inverse is that. What is the other person going through? What is it that we appreciate that they actually sat with us, listened to us, or, you know, they gave us something that they knew we liked, this and that. You know, we appreciate that. So then we can intellectually at least accept that if I do that for others, then they'll be happy. Then we can try it. Experiment. Try it. You know? A little bit. You know, if it comes and we see it, then we'll they like that. Right? That makes sense. So it's also part of our service, part of our sadhana. Right? Brahman's business is to accept charity, give a charity. Learn knowledge, give knowledge. Right? Learn the deity worship, do it for others. Yes. Because it's more dangerous. What I'm saying is they don't have the culture. Because the Vedic impersonalism, then they based fault of the culture. You know? So they were respectable because of their renunciation. like Prabhupada, if there was a bona fide Mayavad sannyasi, the brahmacharis had to offer their obeisances to him, because he was a sannyasi. Bogus ones, that's another thing. Because in the Vedic culture, respect of detachment is very important. But now, of the two, the gross sense gratifier, he doesn't have a philosophy. It's just, he's attracted by his senses. Something he wants, he goes after it. He may have a very mild philosophy, like he who dares wins, or you know, something like that. It's not something very deep. It just is enough to inspire him to do whatever he wants to do. But it's not a philosophy. What I'm saying is, this philosophical deviation can take you lifetimes to get rid of. That essential deviation can be gotten rid of much quicker. Because the intelligence and the mind control the senses. But now if you're using your mind and intelligence to enjoy the senses, you have a philosophy behind it, that's going to be very difficult to correct. Therefore, philosophical deviation is worse. Sensual is just a weakness of the body, of the senses. But a philosophical deviation, this means that you're headed in the wrong direction. Right? That's why Malecha is considered not as bad as a Yavan. Because a Malecha is just a meat eater. They don't know. They're gross. But they can be very pious and nice and gentle and, you know, like that. But a Yavan means that they're an atheist. So even if a Yavan is very sophisticated, very, you know, they've gone to finishing school and all this, still they're worse because they're against the concept of God. The other ones, they believe in God, but they're just rough. They're wild, you know, in their habits. But the Yavana may be rough and wild, or he may be very sophisticated. Ravana is very sophisticated, right? Ravana would chant Vedic mantras. It was so perfect. Agnideep himself would personally go to accept the Purnahuti from him. You know? Of course, Agnideep was told by others not to go personally, but, you know, it was just, he was so expert. He wasn't a gruff, gross, coarse demon. You know? Generally we protect him like that, but he was not. He was very sophisticated. You know? He fought with Indra and Aravata's tusk. You know, his elephant pierced his chest, right? So, you know, in Kshatriya spirit, kind of that fighting spirit, then, you know, I fought and, you know, this is what he wants on this side, but I won on the other side because he defeated. So then, that hole in his chest, he made a diamond-encrusted thing that he put inside. You could see right through his chest from one side to the other, but inside was all nice diamonds. Right? So it's sophisticated, you know? Just like the, you know, it's considered at least, in the, you know, sometime back in the Prussian, what do you call it? Prussian culture, that, you know, an upstanding gentleman had to have a mark of the sword on his face. That meant that he was there fighting. If you didn't have one, then you never fought. But, of course, it's a lower profile thing, because in the Vedic thing you would never speak someone in the face. You know? You would just from the waist up to the neck, this area you could strike. Like that. You wouldn't strike, I mean, you could cut the head off. You know, but you wouldn't mar their face. Because afterwards they go back to their house, they should be able to carry on. If they win, they should carry on. If they lose, then, you know. But it was just different. It was the chivalry was more prominent. But there, chivalry was prominent, but it wasn't so refined. You know? So what I'm saying is the refinement is not the important part. So here, when we get into the philosophy, then it becomes a problem. So New Age is a philosophy. Based on their philosophy, therefore they're enjoying. So that makes it more dangerous. So not only are we trying to become God, but we're also essential. We combine the two. Before you had the Karmis and you had the Gyanis. New Age means combined both. I'm a Gyani for sense gratification. So it's like Charvak. Beg, borrow, a steal, get good. Right? I think Charvak is part of, I think he's part of Vaisheshika, which means everything comes from atoms. You know, totally atheistic. The atoms are the cause of everything. You have Earth, which is the eternal principle, and then you have its transformation, it's whatever it is, you know, a table. And then eventually that will turn back into Earth. The Earth is eternal. Everything comes from the elements. So there's no God, it's just transformation of elements. So that's, you know, basically what the whole modern, you know, so much the science and many of these philosophies are based on. Generally, the Vedic understanding is at a certain point in life, then one just leaves the karma to itself. And because the more you finish, means once you pass a certain point, there's not a whole lot to gain anyway. Once you can't, you know, see properly, taste properly, smell properly, walk properly, I mean, it's, you know, it's kind of beyond the pale. So then, the more of the, your reactions that you burn off in this life means next life you don't have to suffer then. So by the overuse of the medicines and this and that, then we put off reactions. And then it just means next life they'll come up. Right? Like that. So generally at one point it's advised that we depend upon God. Like that. Means that, you know, but whatever. It's just, that's also, it's very much an individual, you know. And you also have to be very careful. If you're working in a hospital, hospitals have their policies, you know. And so you have to follow the hospital policies. Otherwise, then, you know, legal action could be taken. And if one doesn't like that, then one should work in a different field, you know. That's all. Generally, the individual was taught from a young age that, you know, the end of life was thinking of the Lord. It's not just prolonging life just to prolong it. Just to live to be alive. Because you know life is going to go on in the next life. So this life is already useless. You might as well move to the next one. It'll be a lot better, right? You know, this one, you're stuck in an iron lung. But it, once that karma is burned, it doesn't mean that the next one's going to be like that. So it's, we create our own difficulties. If a devotee has cancer and decides not to get the treatment, is that suicide? Generally, what one would do is you know, go through those activities to see if it goes away easy enough. You know, some medicines or lifestyle or diet change, whatever that needs. If that works nicely, then fine. Because, you know, we can always do with more purification in our life. Because the more pure we are before dying, then the better. But if we find that it's going to be an all-consuming occupation is just trying to get rid of our cancer, and it's not going, then the Ayurveda mentions, because it's a very heavy karma vyadi. It's a karmic disease. And no matter what medicine or this or that you take, it won't go away. So at that point, then we just depend upon Krishna and let it run its course. But simply by taking some simple treatment and this and that, then what's the problem? But if it's going to be something very major, then it won't go away. Or they say it's, you know, it's chronic, or if that's it, then why bother? Because then one can very, you know, what Maharaj Pariksit was considered fortunate because he knew he was dying in 1 week, so he could fix his mind. So we've seen here, I think, of at least one or two devotees, also in Vrindavan, devotees know that they're leaving. And so they very nicely just fix their mind and they go nice. Right? Means there was one devotee, saw Vrindavan, came there because it was getting, it had a disease for many years. And, you know, it wasn't going so well, but somehow or another it kind of went into recession. Then it suddenly came back very heavily. And doctors weren't quite sure what it was. They were saying one thing, someone was saying another, this, that. But it was getting a little freaky, so he went to Vrindavan. Then a few days later, you know, 1 or 2 days later, myself and another devotee from Vrindavan went to visit him. And he's talking and this and that, and he's, you know, saying so much, you know, I'm here, you know, it's time to go, Krishna, and he has his plan and so many things. But if Krishna, you know, he had contacted somebody about some medicine, but if Krishna wants the medicine to work, I don't mind going on and continuing in his, you know, whatever he wants me to serve, this, that, like this. So in his mind, it wasn't just going. It was like, by all symptoms, it looks like I'm going, but I would rather find a cure and not go. So as we were leaving, you know, after all the discussion, because that other devotee I was with and that person were, you know, old friends and they knew him. When we were leaving, a person made the comment, that says, I've seen many devotees like under Vrindavan to die. And they all know they're going to die. But he says that this devotee doesn't, he has not accepted yet that he is going to die. And he just went on whatever it is like this. 1 week later he was dead. Just suddenly. So even though all symptoms were there, he in his mind had focused that leaving. Because once you do that, you become very serious. The mind suddenly gets very serious when it sees it, you know, sense gratification or it's going to be heavily restricted. The mind suddenly becomes very serious. You know, I've seen sometimes once it was during Durga Puja, which is like Christmas in Bengal, I happened to be in charge of the guest house. When I think we had two floors of the Lotus building as the guest room. So we had, I think, eight rooms, one downstairs. So if even two or three rooms were full, it was like, you know, you were overworked. You know, because there was no cooks, no facilities, nothing. If a guest came rarely, then you went around and found a devotee to cook. You know, it's like one of those things. You know, it was not like now where it's constantly full and they have big arrangements and that. So during that, it goes for like 2 weeks, 10 days is the madhouse. Somehow or another, I was very sick at the time, and, you know, guests were there and all this, and I'd gotten behind my rounds. And every day I get up with the determination, we're going to chant, we're going to finish a round today. Every day wouldn't finish. So then after 2 or 3 days, then I thought, this is getting crazy. And so could never, you know, it just wouldn't work. So then I decided, okay, we'll do this. When I finish my rounds, then I will eat. Like that. So the morning went by, naturally very busy and everything like this, and never being able to find time. You know, went past breakfast, no problem, and, you know, very busy, it is Durga Puja and all that. And then, kind of in the early afternoon and that, well, we better, you know, get chanting some rounds and all that, you know. But then by the evening, when the mind figured out, you know, we're getting hungry and we're not eating until we finish the rounds, somehow or another, the mind found plenty of time to chant, and we chanted all the rounds at night, like that. So it's a very, very useful thing. When the mind knows this is it, it becomes very serious. So it's, in the Vedic consideration, it's not considered a bad thing. If your goal is to go back to Godhead, if your goal is to hold on to the last second, then it's not a very good path. Yes. You heard Mataji is asking that when we're doing our, we must be sick and we're trying to do service, but then we can't do it so nicely. So then, does Krishna understand that? You know? Does he understand? So that's naturally true. Because the point is, he's the one that's sanctioning our purification anyway. So the reason that we can become sick is because he's allowed it. Means due to our previous activities, we've done things that we should be sick. So Krishna is so then he understands. The main thing is that whatever the situation, we always remember him and don't forget him. That's the essential thing. We try to chant, we try to hear, we try to remember, like that. That we try to do. But if our specific service we can't do, that's another thing. Krishna understands. You know, what we do our best. Who are these guys, though? Okay, so we'll end here. Tomorrow we have Prashad Seva. Then devotees. And yeah, reception of guests. Okay. Om Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare.